In response to my attacks, Newt Gingrich threatened to refuse to raise the debt limit and thus put America in default if I vetoed their budget bills. Raising the debt limit was merely a technical act that recognized the inevitable. As long as America continued to run deficits, the annual debt would increase, and the government would be required to sell more bonds to finance it. Increasing the debt limit simply gave the Treasury Department authority to do that. As long as Democrats were in the majority, Republicans could cast symbolic votes against raising the debt limit and pretend that they hadn't contributed to the necessity to do it. Many Republicans in the House had never voted to raise the debt limit and didn't relish doing so now. So I had to take Gingrich's threat seriously. If America defaulted on its debt, the consequences could be severe. In more than 200 years, the United States had never failed to pay its debts. Defaults would shake investor confidence in our reliability. As we headed into the final showdown, I couldn't deny that Newt had a bargaining chip, but I was determined not to be blackmailed. If he followed through on his threat, he would be hurt too. Default ran the risk of increasing interest rates, and even a small increase would add hundreds of billions of dollars to home mortgage payments. 10 million Americans had variable rate mortgages tied to federal interest rates. If Congress didn't raise the debt limit, people could have to pay what Al Gore called a Gingrich surcharge on their monthly mortgage payments. The Republicans would have to think twice before letting America go into default. In October, Hillary and I celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary. I got her a pretty diamond ring to mark a milestone in our lives and to make up for the fact that when she agreed to marry me, I didn't have enough money to buy her an engagement ring. Hillary loved the little diamonds across the thin band and wore the ring as a reminder that through all our ups and downs, we were still very much engaged. On Saturday, November 4th, 1995, Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by an Israeli extremist. In the 2.5 years we had worked together, Rabin and I had developed an unusually close relationship, marked by candor, trust, and an extraordinary understanding of each other's political positions and thought processes. We had become friends in that unique way people do when they are in a struggle that they believe is great and good. With every encounter, I came to respect and care for him more. By the time he was killed, I had come to love him as I have rarely loved another man. In the back of my mind, I suppose I always knew he had put his life at risk, but I couldn't imagine him gone, and I didn't know what I would or could do in the Middle East without him. Overcome with grief, I went to spend a couple of hours with Hillary. Hillary and I were accompanied to Rabin's funeral in Jerusalem by former Presidents Carter and Bush, the congressional leadership, and 36 other senators and representatives, General Shalai Kashvili, former Secretary of State George Shultz, and several prominent business leaders. As soon as we landed, Hillary and I went to the Rabin home to see Yitzhak's wife, Leah. She was heartbroken, but trying to put on a brave front for her family and her country. King Hussein gave a magnificent eulogy. Rabin's granddaughter, Noah, then doing her service in the Israeli army, moved the audience by speaking to her grandfather. "Grandpa, you were the pillar of fire before the camp, and now we are just a camp left alone in the dark, and we're so cold." In my remarks, I tried to rally the people of Israel to keep following their fallen leader. That very week, Jews around the world were studying that portion of the Torah in which God commanded Abraham to sacrifice his beloved son Isaac, or Yitzhak. Once Abraham demonstrated his willingness to obey, God spared the boy. I said, "Now God tests our faith even more terribly, for he has taken our Yitzhak." But Israel's covenant with God for freedom, for tolerance, for security, for peace, that covenant must hold. That covenant was Prime Minister Rabin's life's work. Now we must make it his lasting legacy. I close with Shalom Haver. Somehow those two words, Shalom Haver, goodbye friend, had captured the feelings of Israelis about Rabin. I had a number of Jewish staff members who spoke Hebrew and knew how I felt about Rabin. I will always be grateful that they gave me the phrase. Shimon Peres later told me that Haver means more than mere friendship. It evokes the comradeship of soulmates in common cause. Soon, Shalom Haver began to appear on billboards and bumper stickers all across Israel. After the funeral, I held a few meetings with other leaders at the King David Hotel with its magnificent view of the old city of Jerusalem, then headed back to Washington. It was almost 4:30 a.m. when we touched down at Andrews Air Force Base, and all the weary travelers staggered off the plane to get whatever rest they could before the budget battle moved into its final phase. Ever since the new fiscal year had begun on October 1st, the government had been running on a continuing resolution, or CR, which authorized funding for departments until their new budgets were enacted. It wasn't all that unusual for a new fiscal year to begin without Congress passing a couple of appropriations bills, but now we had the whole government on a CR with no end in sight. By contrast, in my first 2 years, the Democratic Congress had approved the budgets on time. On November 10th, 3 days before the expiration of the continuing resolution, Congress sent me a new one that threw down the gauntlet. The price for keeping the government open was signing a new CR that increased Medicare premiums 25%, cut funding for education and the environment, and weakened our environmental laws. The following day, just a week after Rabin's assassination, I gave my radio address on the Republican attempts to pass their budget through the back door of the CR. It was Veterans Day, so I pointed out that 8 million of the seniors whose Medicare premiums would be raised were veterans. There was no need for the GOP's draconian cuts. The combined rates of unemployment and inflation were at a 25-year low. Federal employment as a percentage of the overall workforce was the smallest since 1933, and the deficit was down. I still wanted to balance the budget, but in a way that was consistent with our fundamental values and without threats or partisan rancor. On Monday night, the Congress finally sent me an extension of the debt limit. It was worse than the CR, another backdoor effort to pass the budget cuts and weaken environmental laws. The legislation also stripped from the Secretary of the Treasury the fund management flexibility he had had since the Reagan years to avoid defaults under extraordinary circumstances. Even worse, it lowered the debt limit again after 30 days, virtually ensuring a default. Gingrich had been threatening since April to shut the government down and put America in default if I didn't accept his budget. I couldn't tell whether he really wanted to do it or whether he simply believed all the press coverage during my first 2 years that, in the face of ample evidence to the contrary, had portrayed me as too weak, too willing to abandon commitments, too eager to compromise. If so, he should have paid more attention to the evidence. On November 13th, with the existing CR scheduled to expire at midnight, the negotiators met one more time to try to resolve our differences before the government shut down. Senator Dole and Speaker Gingrich were there, along with House Majority Leader Dick Armey. For the Democrats, Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota and Representative Dick Gebhardt from Missouri were there, as were Al Gore, Leon Panetta, Bob Rubin, Laura Tyson, and other members of our team. The atmosphere was already tense when Gingrich started the meeting by complaining about our TV ads. We had started running ads in targeted states in June to highlight administration achievements, beginning with the crime bill. When the budget debate heated up after Labor Day, the ads targeted the proposed Republican cuts, especially in Medicare and Medicaid. After Newt carried on for a while, Leon Panetta tersely reminded him of all the terrible things he'd said about me before the 1994 election. "Mr. Speaker, you don't have clean hands." Dole tried to calm things, saying he didn't want the government to shut down. At that point, Dick Armey broke in to say Dole didn't speak for the House Republicans. Armey was a big, burly man who always wore cowboy boots and seemed to be in a constant state of agitation. He launched into a tirade about how the House Republicans were determined to be true to their principles and how angry he was that my TV ads on the Medicare cuts had frightened his elderly mother-in-law. I replied that I didn't know about his mother-in-law, but if the Republican budget cuts were to become law, large numbers of elderly people would be forced out of nursing homes or lose their home health care. Armey replied gruffly that if I didn't give in to them, they would shut the government down and my presidency would be over. I shot back, saying I would never allow their budget to become law. Quote, "Even if I dropped to 5% in the polls, if you want your budget, you'll have to get someone else to sit in this chair." Not surprisingly, we didn't make a deal. After the meeting, Daschle, Gebhardt, and my team were elated by my confrontation with Armey. Al Gore said he just wished everyone in America had heard my declaration, except I should have said that I didn't care if I fell to zero in the polls. I looked back at him and said, "No, Al, if we drop to 4%, I'm caving." We all laughed, but our insides were still in knots.